One of the big stories from Kansas City's music scene this year was the new album from the band Making Movies. The album's called Americana, and one of the songs on the album, called Delilah, was a long-dormant collaboration between Lou Reed and Ruben Blades. The song was never released in its own time, and for this album, Blades revisited the song with Kansas City's own Enrique Chi, the frontman for Making Movies. Here on Central Standard, we were pretty excited about it, and we're not the only ones who took note. It made a big splash throughout the U.S. and beyond. Critics were calling it for a Grammy from the start, and the band did get a nod in the Latin Grammys this year. One of their videos played during the television broadcast of the awards. Let's listen back to the interview we did with Enrique Chi back in May. Hey, Enrique.
Yeah, good morning, Gina.
I want to start with this new album, Americana. It's a concept album that's supposed to be almost like an artifact from our troubled times discovered by people living in a better future.
Yeah, it didn't form exactly that way. It formed more off inspired by our first collaboration with Ruben. You know, he's this iconic musical figure. To me, to Latin America, he's like a Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen-like character, especially with his social activism and things. And he wrote a song called No Te Calles using our music, and he sang it with us. And we thought, well, we should definitely make an album. And the theme of that song was so pointed. It's basically asking you to never be silenced. So we knew that Never Be Silenced as a community, you know, against social ills or corruption and injustice. So we figured that this album, we couldn't really throw on a afternoon love song in it. You know, it's like if that song's going to be on the album, all the rest, it's like he gave us marching orders. But then that evolved and it became so collaborative. A lot of our friends are in the same situation. So we have this almost mixtape-like feeling to it. And so it started to feel like it was almost like you're flipping through radio stations. And so we gave it a premise so that what if we were in the future and we're listening to an oldie station and you could just reminisce about how times used to be tough and now we're just enjoying the beautiful music and we've solved it all.
So instead of like good times, great oldies, it's like, man, those were rough times.
Yeah.
Rough oldies.
Rough times, great oldies. Yeah, I mean, isn't that kind of how it is, though? Isn't some of the great 60s music describing some unrest? And I think that's part of the joy of music.
So you told a little bit of the story of how this album came about, and I've listened to a lot of it. I'm dying over it, but I am especially dying to share the Lou Reed song, Delilah, because I think the story in rock music that of what you've done with that song might be historic. And, you know, I would love to hear more about where it came from, how this came about.
Well, Ruben and Lou Reed, they became friends. So Ruben has been on this wavelength for a long time. I mean, he made his most popular record, the record that took salsa music to the world, in 1978. And so by the 80s, he was a superstar, and he did like a 60 Minutes interview and was kind of being adopted by both sides, both Latinos and as an American pop culture figure, because he also did a few huge movies in that time period. And he wanted to make an album in English that would help expose his messages to non-Spanish-speaking audiences, and he asked for collaborators, and Lou Reed came on to be the producer. He also had like Elvis Costello and Sting and all these other folks on this album. Though the release of the album, he described it this way at the interview we just did. He's like, it was disastrous. Like, the record label didn't know what to do with. I mean, if you imagine, music is still fairly segregated. You don't turn on a country station and also then hear a Spanish song. Not exactly. Music's still fairly segregated. But even back then, it was far more so. And so they didn't know what to do with this work. And in that time period, he wrote a lot of songs with Lou Reed, the producer. They did like a retreat at his house. And they just agreed that everything they wrote that week, they would split up 50-50. And this is one of the songs born. And he doesn't remember why it didn't make the record, but he had it kind of lying around, dusted it off, a little demo he had made of it, and sent it to us. And was like, hey, see what y'all could do with this. And we were like, what? Like,
yeah, this is that's crazy.
A song you wrote with Lou Reed. We were very afraid of it. Like, what do we send Ruben as our demo of a song he wrote with Lou Reed? How do we stack up to that? So Juan Carlos had an idea of mimicking this kind of grungy 90s records that Los Lobos' frontman made called the Latin Playboys. And we were thinking, listening to those records, like maybe something kind of dirty like that would work to fit the Lou Reed aesthetic and also make it sound comfortable for Ruben to duet on it. And we played it for Ruben in New York, our demo, and he goes, I like it, let's do it.
And the story, the reference to Delilah, can you explain that real quick before we listen to the song?
So Delilah, like in the biblical story, Samson and Delilah, he falls in love with this woman who seduces him, but then really uses him and takes his powers. And Delilah represents the United States. And for all the great things the United States offers people, that it still offers some great things to be here, it also has propagated a myth that Latin America has generally believed that if you just arrive here, life is by de facto and improved and better. And you know, that myth is propagated through pop culture a lot of times, and through propaganda too. You know, the U.S. has put up political leaders all over Latin America and has put up propaganda. And so people show up here with this myth version of the United States, and that's what Delilah represents.
Okay, this is Delilah, performed by Making Movies on their new album coming out later this month. It was written by Lou Reed and Ruben Blades. Let's give it a listen. Enrique Chi, I have been a Lou Reed and Velvet Underground fan for a long, long time. I've been following your career too, and hearing this is like, I can't even explain it. It feels like you and Lou Reed had a baby.
In a weird way, we did. You know, we're cutting up a little like promo clip for this album, and I thought like we need to include like at least in this promo edit a photo of Lou Reed and Ruben hanging out, because without that happening, this album wouldn't exist. There's so many factors that came into play for us to make this. It's
and that's
crazy.
Such a passing of the torch too for him to hand that off to you.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
There are a lot of collaborations on this album other than the collaboration between you and Ruben Blades, there are a lot of other musicians you bring in, and that's nothing new for you. When you talk about this story of Ruben Blades reaching out to these English-speaking musicians from the U.S. to collaborate and bring his message to more listeners, you have your own history of reaching out to other musicians on pretty much every album you've done.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a part of like really great music scenes has always been a collaborative spirit. I think sometimes in the modern music age, you realize it more because they credit it differently now than they used to. But I think if you were part of like the East Village in New York City, and you're one of those folk songwriters, you would have been playing on each other's records and singing on each other's records. Same with like the same scene that Bird, Jackson Browne, and the Eagles and all those artists, same thing. They would play on each other's records. The scene that we're a part of is not a geographic scene. Not a lot of it is in Kansas City. Most of our collaborators live elsewhere, but through the wonders of technology and the fact that flights are cheap, you can kind of rebuild a scene or build a scene that's just based on a common spirit.
I want to play a song that includes members of Flor de Toloache because the sound is so different from the sound of the song with the Lou Reed influence. So for our listeners, it'll be like clear that when you collaborate, it's not superficial. But I wonder if you can set up kind of a little bit about this song before we hear it.
Sure. This is Rebellion. So Mireya, the lead singer of Flor de Toloache, it's like all the artists on this record have some message that they try to get out through their music. And Mireya talks a lot about her her life being, she's part Mexican and part Dominican, but she's an Afro-Latina. And being like the Afro-Mexican culture is really just now starting to be, you know, treated like a culture that has existed. It was almost like they wrote it out of the history books kind of a thing. And she's really passionate about that. And she has covered an old salsa song called Las Caras Lindas that talks about those issues in Flor de Toloache's. It was actually the name of their last record. So this is a similar tune where it's a salsa song that speaks of the issues of being an Afro-Latino and the racism. And I thought it would be perfect to have her sing it. We were here in Kansas City with Steve Berlin, and we had an extra, we were trying to just get Delilah done and one other song, and things were just flowing. That's also part of how the record was born. And we had all the studios set up, and we had just captured a take, and we had maybe an hour left in the studio that night. And Steve's like, is there anything else that would fit this? And he pulled out one of the demos that I had sent him. He's like, what about Rebellion? And so we called her. I was like, we're about to do a take of this. Would you sing this?
And she lives in New York, right?
She lives in New York. And like, would you be down to sing this? She's like, oh, yeah, that'd be awesome. And then we hung up the phone. We walked in the booth, and it was the first take. It just magic struck.
And she was not physically present.
She was not physically present. So we did all the music and then had the girls add trumpet, violin, and vocals.
Because they are an all-female mariachi band.
Yep, they're all-female mariachi band, and they're awesome. They're fun. They're fun musicians. They're brilliant, and also just have become really great friends.
Okay, so let's hear this magical first take.
Años 1600, cuando el tirano mandó las calles de Cartagena, aquella historia vivió.
What do you hope people take from this new Making Movies album, Americana, when you perform songs from it next weekend at the Nelson? It's about the music, but it's clearly about more than music.
Well, I hope that that this album can kind of continue. Actually, it's something that has Dio and I were talking about this last night. Dio is my brother who plays bass in the band, and when we really look at it in our history, Kansas City has been quite progressive with us from a national perspective.
What do you mean by that?
In that multiple communities have embraced us and have championed us in certain ways. So we have the old rock and roll community, not old, but the one that I grew up seeing and watching the bands like that community ended up becoming the owners of places like the Record Bar, or they own the studio that we recorded that song in. And I grew up watching their bands, and I knew that they, if I could get my parents to take me to Streetside Records downtown, I could buy one of those CDs, and it's like the alternative rock scene. Then also the Latino community has also supported us, and then also just kind of like the we're here at NPR, listener kind of music head community has also supported us. And Kansas City is a small place, so it's a it's like a nice petri dish of what we hope to see happen in every city in this country, where instead of being put in one corner, you can have all these diverse communities enjoy this music, because I know it's possible, because I've seen it multiple places. And I think that something else I learned about ourselves in the last year, ever since the Ruben Blades thing happened, we've really grown in Panama. They've embraced us and put us on bigger national stages. And I realized
he gave you a shout out at the Latin Grammys.
He gave us a shout out at the Latin Grammys, and we released No Te Calles in January and got a lot of buzz from that. Rolling Stone premiered it, and Associated Press put it in newspapers all over Latin America because of the message and just how much political unrest was happening at that time. And so that really reverberated in Latin America more than it did in the United States. And that what I realized about Panamanian culture is, because of the canal and because of the influence of American culture being so strong there, Panamanians are fluid culturally. They can dive into a very American or United States type of event, idea, and they can also code switch and be really like Latino, and have the indigenous roots and embrace those things too. And so it's been cool to see how Panama has embraced, how that part of Panamanian culture is really beautiful. It's not a perfect culture. It has its flaws like many other, like every other culture. But I'm seeing that in Kansas City, that there's this like diverse listeners, and the record's really diverse. But I think that there's a common theme through all of it. And that's kind of like the message of our whole band.
It's very refreshing to hear that, because in so many conversations, we keep repeating this idea of how divided we are.
And that's a big issue, but that's really beautiful here, even more than other cities. If there's any Chicago listeners listening, it's no offense to that, but we have a nice audience in Chicago, but they're almost all Latino. There's enough Latinos there that we were put in that corner, played those events, and that brought us those kind of audience. There's not enough Latinos here to support us, so it's grown through a diverse community, and so that's kind of beautiful about Kansas City and their support of our band, and we're grateful for that.
So some teenagers are going to open up for you at that show at the Nelson, and I want you to tell that story now.
So it's a bit of a long one, and I have not found a real succinct way to tell it. I'm going to do my best. 8-9 years ago, I realized that there are voids in Kansas City of where certain inner city communities, music education was almost non-existent. And when I dove deeper in, I realized it was worse than I thought. I asked to volunteer at the Matty Rhodes Center teaching guitar lessons, because I saw there was recent immigrant kids and I related with that. But I realized that they weren't even ready to grasp or to accept the concept that they could learn music.
How did you? What did you see that gave you that impression?
Oh, they literally, like I pulled out a guitar, and sometimes they'd be drawn to it. One student, Umberto, who's become a good friend of mine now, he's an adult, and we hire him to teach guitar lessons for our music camp. He knew he loved it, but he kind of would look at his friends and be like, I don't know if this is like a thing I'm allowed to do or supposed to do. If there's no frame of reference for something like that, you just can't conceive of it.
It's someone else's.
That's something other people do, and I don't know if I'm the kind of person that's supposed to do that.
Oh.
And so that was the first barrier. So we started a music camp, and we were running the music camp, but we kept meeting kids. I think anytime there's a kid that gets connected to music, you're going to find some of them that choose music as a way to express their experience. Now, when that experience comes with some systemic challenges by social class or racism, or then you get something really powerful where you have young people using music as a vehicle to show the honesty of their perspective. And the fact that they're too young to be dishonest is so powerful. I mean, that's the most amazing thing with any musician. What makes Lou Reed great, he wasn't a genius singer or guitar player. It's an honesty. And so I realized that as a survival mechanism, we were running the camp, our bands, we're not educators professionally, and we're definitely not camp coordinators either, but we wanted to do it. We were figuring it out, and we're like, how do we level the playing field and get everybody involved? And I had an idea. I was like, why don't I do like a songwriting portion? Because when the camp grew, we kind of were up above or in or above our heads. And songwriting, you could level the playing field because somebody didn't have to know how to sing to say to conceive what idea would go next. And somebody didn't know how to play it to say that is the right chord.
Or no reading music because you're making it up.
You're making it up. And then there's an ownership. And then that ownership led to a certain empowerment. And then once they felt empowered, I made this song and they presented it at the end of the week because that's the other premise, the kids had to present it. Then the sense of accomplishment and being applauded for your own creation, I saw a shift, and that was in a matter of a few days. So we knew that at some point we had to expand that work, and that's what we did. We started Artist Mentorship, a not-for-profit, to run a youth songwriter program. And the students not only were working on their own development as songwriters, but they were working to collaborate together. And I don't know if this has ever existed quite this way. I've seen other not-for-profits on our touring and stuff that do amazing music education work, but the idea that 16 teenagers participated and contributed to one song in teams.
Yes, this baffles me because 16 people writing one anything, writing one paragraph, you know, that would be hard. 16 teenagers writing one song, how do you do that?
Well, I had a guess on how it could work, right? Because the premise was always to elevate these young people's voices so that they really felt like they had value. And so a lot of friends helped me conceive of how to do this. John Hart from The Bridge and some other local musicians, they're like, well, right off the bat, even some parents, I had think tanks where I was like, I want to do this. You're a parent, you've been in music for a long time, you've been in music education, let's come hang out, and I want to glean what I can learn from you. And they all said, from the get-go, treat them like adults, and treat them like their art represents something, and they'll rise to the occasion, and that proved to be true. So they were always working under the premise that in a few short weeks, Steve Berlin of Los Lobos, this musical legend, was going to be here to record them. And that also kind of like disengaged any ego and because they were all kind of intimidated by it equally.
Yeah, that it wasn't someone who had to prove themselves to the teenagers, that it was someone who had that stature.
Yes. And they're like, wow, this is a great opportunity. I've never worked in a studio. Now we're bringing somebody in. He has Grammys. They may not know what that means, but I've heard that means something, so I'm gonna work hard. And so we divided them up into teams based on strength, like a lyric team, a music production team, a harmony team, and that's how we were able to have them all collaborate. But to me, like, the song moves me very much because when I hear it, I know every student who did every little thing, the piano part, and I know their backstory, and it just like it really warms my heart. It
makes like a family portrait.
Yes, I can hear all their personalities in it.
Well, their song is called, it's called Living My Best Life, right?
That's right.
Let's hear it.
Song goes out to anybody trying to live it up, baby.
No palm trees to say this is paradise. Life is tricky like a paradise. Gonna live in the moment, gonna make it mine. Living my best life. Not gonna waste no time in this moment, this emotion. I don't wanna miss a beat.
This is the lyrics themselves. It's so optimistic.
Yep. Yeah, they did the lyrics themselves.
What do you think living my best life means? Just having spent the time with them and being witness to the process of them agreeing that this is the message they wanted to get out into the world?
I think for them it means finding identity. I think that they were in that transformative stage where each one of them is in the process of figuring out, like, who am I? And And it actually was really beautiful. More so, the whole process, I knew it would be awesome because the music camps have been awesome. But it exceeded every expectation that I had from the students and from their creative output. And I could see that some of them, even within the process, shifted their own sense of identity.
It's a good song.
Yeah, it's also, yeah, they wrote a great song.
When you, I got a call, I think it was Tuesday night, from one of the teens you worked with. She was practicing the skill of pitching her work to members of the media. That was part of the training. It was not just learning how to write and perform and record a song. Can you talk about that piece of it? Why that's significant?
Yeah, to me, the real, so there's a lot of different purposes in the program, but the real goal was to have this real deep level of understanding happen for these young people, that no matter what you choose to do in your life, your perspective has value, and sharing that has extreme value, whether that's just with your family and your nearest partners, or whether you're sharing it with a huge, on a podium with hundreds of thousands of people. Your perspective has value. And so lesson number one. Lesson number two that needed to come through this is, if you want to make anything in this world, there are a million steps between your bedroom where you conceive the idea on your notebook to it existing. And within those steps, you always have to collaborate. I can't think of anything creative or generative that one can do completely on an island. You need a team of people around you that believe in it, and you have to learn how to rally that team together. And so to me, the entrepreneurial side of it is less about learning how you could someday make money, because it's really hard to make money with music, but it was more so, but it can be done. You can learn how to make a sustainable living. It's more so like, if you're trying to do anything, it could be a movement, an activist thing, creating a business, you have to work through all these steps and believe in yourself through it.
Enrique Chi, thank you so much. We will keep following the progress of your Rebel Song Academy, and congratulations on your new album.
Thank you so much, Gina.
Enrique Chi joined us in May. That block party outside the Nelson was wildly successful, by the way. It drew a huge crowd, and it was just a really memorable day of people coming together around music here in Kansas City. Making Movies is part of a big New Year's Eve show with lots of great bands happening at the Truman, so be sure and check that out if you want to celebrate with these guys. We'll get right back to this Best of 2019 show with an American soldier who tried to tell his wife about one crazy day in Afghanistan. It ended up taking a whole book. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and our next guest is the author of a book from the University Press of Kansas, Taliban Safari. It's about one day spent fighting an American war abroad. The book is an attempt to answer a seemingly simple question: what happened today? Paul Darling, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Set the scene for it was your wife who asked you the question that inspired the book, where you are when she asked the question, what's going on, and why her question is so hard to just answer.
Well, it was after a long day, and I had to make a phone call. And so it's tough. You are really two people when you're deployed. You kind of let, as the Jung would call it, the shadow out a little bit. And you don't want
to. What does that mean?
Well, there's a dark side. There's a violent side to all of us. That, you know, if you ever saw the movie Full Metal Jacket, you know, they talk about the duality of man. He's got the born to kill and the peace symbol on there, and there's some truth to that in there. And to effectively work in that kind of environment, at least in combat, you kind of have to let that dark side out a little bit. You used to call it the beast. But then when you talk to your kids and wife, you got to put that away real quick. And it's a very tough transition. And so when I called my wife, I guess, if you read the book, you'll see it didn't take her long to figure out that something was different. And I took a little bit longer to put that away, and she caught up on it. And I didn't want to talk about it. It's hard enough to talk about 10 years later. So I kind of said, all right, I don't want to tell you exactly, but I'll tell you later. And that was the book.
In the first couple of pages of this book, you the reader, I suspect that this actually wasn't your intention, but I felt like truly on some level assaulted by a very straightforward and unceremonious description of a human being found dead after a fight, which is the word you use where those of us who have no experience with war might say something like battle. And then within the same first several pages, you describe the dismay you feel by subpar Velcro that is used on pockets, on the clothing that you need to wear, which causes things to fall out of the pockets. But the range of information here goes from the utterly mundane to the existentially grim. And it does it quickly and without your signaling in your writing style that you're going from one to the other. You talk about all of this stuff very straightforwardly, which I commend you for. It's disorienting.
I can accept that. The first chapter was by far the hardest chapter to write. How do you describe the mundane details of getting ready for a mission? And they are, as you say, mundane. While at the same time, kind of capturing the what's going through your head. What are you thinking about? It's early in the morning. I'm about to, put myself and my men in danger. So you kind of got to go from the literal transfer of what was the day like to kind of set up why this matters. Why do I worry about Velcro that falls out? Why do I worry about silly things? Because that's what's on my mind. That was what I was thinking about. And the book should hopefully be read with the idea that this was just an explanation to my wife. So I'm sure in a phone call or a letter home or something, I complained about the pants or something. It's like, these pants are driving me nuts. Oh, I got pilot pants. They have zippers. This is awesome. This is like the best day ever.
I understand that the full title of this book, which I'll let you say because it contains a word that I can't pronounce, but the full title of the book is a reference to One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Can you start by telling me about that book?
Well, great book. Obviously, Solzhenitsyn, and I'm probably butchering his name despite the fact
that
I took Russian.
No, I think that's right.
Oh, right. Yes. Obviously, Gulag Archipelago, Nobel Prize for Literature, fantastic if depressing book. But I always preferred Ivan Denisovich as a novel because it was a mechanism to immerse someone who had never been in the Gulag and had no experience with it, what it was like through the explanation of the mundane.
What I remember about that book, and I read it about 20 years ago, so forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, if it's maybe taken on a different life in my mind, but I remember the main character washing his face. And I remember that being profound because everything he experiences is so dehumanizing, and his commitment to just washing his face is a form of resistance. Washing your face is something that I, in my comfortable dorm room at that time, took pretty well for granted. I'm wondering if that's part of your interest in those mundane daily things, is that that's part of like the universal in human life.
I think so. And when you're in an exceptional environment like that, it's little things that you wouldn't think about. Washing your face, pockets where stuff doesn't fall out, old coffee, beef jerky, goo packets and hardening naan in the afternoon.
Frustration with traffic.
Oh, yes. Hours to go simple kilometers when there's a perfectly usable road right next to you that you apparently it's not perfectly usable. But we paid top dollar for it. The American taxpayer did, unfortunately. So, and the same thing, I was struck in Ivan Denisovich. For me, if you remember the book when he was building the wall with their bricks and they're yelling and they're working as hard as they can in sub-zero temperatures for a building that will probably fall apart a few years later, may never even be used, and yet they took such pride in it. It was a mechanism for him to maintain his humanity, to be good at laying these bricks for a despotic regime that doesn't care if he lives or die, but he's going to maintain his humanity by doing a good job and taking pride in that. So I try to capture, I guess, just the little things that matter to try to show how we maintain our humanity in these exceptional circumstances.
Why were you at war? You personally, not America. That's another question, but you chose to go, right?
I did. I volunteered, yes, multiple times. West Point graduate. The Army and the country paid a lot of money to do that. And you spend a lot of time preparing yourself to do something, and then you want to see, can you do it? And I was deployed many years earlier in Bosnia as a lieutenant. And to be honest, it's kind of nice to let the shadow out and play a little bit. They talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you want to self-actualize, you got to beat yourself down. You got to be hungry. You got to be cold. You got to be tired. Combat is all of that.
That's quite a thing to admit, to tell you the truth, to admit that that's part of why you went to fight in a war.
Yeah, it is. There's nothing like it. It is addicting. Combat is amazingly addicting. Winston Churchill, nothing so exhilarating as to be shot at without effect. And to be among other people who actively sought out that experience, and most of the men I fought with were volunteers who volunteered for that mission and certainly volunteered for what was very hard combat in Zabel. It's a special group of people that you're privileged to be with.
There's no political commentary in this book. I understand that it once was present, but that you stripped it out.
Not so much politics. I think it was more of a greater indictment of the mission, and that fault I fought when Barack Obama was newly elected, but clearly inherited much of George Bush's policies. The changes were minimal between the two. So if there is any commentary of a political nature, they were certainly bipartisan criticisms.
So there was commentary, though.
Agreed.
And that it was stripped out.
A little bit. There wasn't a whole lot. I am definitely at the micro level. Suffice to say that we imposed on Afghanistan a concept of governance and a concept of democracy, which the Pashtun people in particular, where I was at, and I think the Uzbeks and Tajiks and Hazaras and the rest, weren't exactly familiar with. And many people took advantage of what we tried to impose. I was very fortunate. I got to talk with General, later Ambassador Eikenberry, who was commanding general of all forces in Afghanistan and then became the ambassador to Afghanistan for the United States when he retired. And I got to talk to him when I was studying at Duke. And I said, look, I think the constitution that Afghanistan had was a disaster. And he laughed. And I'm like, oh, wow. Well, sorry, Ambassador. It's just what I thought. And he said, no, I laughed because I was just talking to someone 20 minutes ago. And I said, that constitution didn't work. That was our biggest mistake.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll pick right back up with this discussion about Taliban Safari, one day in the life of Surkhagan Valley, with the author, Paul Darling, on KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my guest is Paul Darling. He's written a book all about one day that lasts 16 hours on a crazy mission in Afghanistan, tracking down Taliban insurgents. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
So we aren't going to be able to tell the listeners everything that happened in that day. Clearly, it took you a book. But what is your mission that day? What are you setting out to do?
So what happened is earlier on, we stumbled into an ambush and we came out on top. And in the course of that, the commander of troops for the Taliban was killed. And so my general, who is a Pashtun and with a lot of experience fighting Afghanistan, literally decades of it, suspected that that day they'd be sending in a new commander and he would have to do a mission to kind of establish his chops. He was coming from out of province. We got that on intelligence. So we took a guess where he'd be at. And we went to hunt them down.
You went past where they were to come from the opposite direction, something like that?
A little bit more of we went deep south and then we hooked around. There's a lot of timelines involved, and I talk about the tyranny of time in the mission.
Yeah, I remember this decision to sort of overshoot and hook around. Can you explain that?
Well, the Taliban have good mobility with their motorcycles. They have magnificent knowledge of the terrain. And I'd fought them enough to know that they don't want to stand up to a fight. I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to either, considering the firepower that we brought. So I had a very limited timeline in which I could stop them from getting in the mountains where I just couldn't chase them down. So I wanted them to think I was doing something different. And I used a suspected Taliban spy in the Afghan government or the Zabul government to relay false information. And then the mission was designed to reinforce that false information that I assumed was leaked to the Taliban so that we got them complacent, and then we used the Apaches to stop them from disappearing into the mountains, and it worked.
So they would like to avoid this fight, but I was fascinated by the detail that the men on your mission were—that the idea of not encountering people to fight would actually be very frustrating for this group of men.
Absolutely. You know, so the infantryman is a kind of a different creature, you know, and I tried to describe a little bit to the men I served with, but I didn't know them that well. I hadn't commanded them for long before this mission, and I was the commander, and you know, you have that isolation. But they like a fight. They are football players. They were MMA fighters. They were guys who joined the infantry specifically and volunteered for this mission because they were looking for a fight.
And there are two of them who are kind of like funhouse mirror versions of each other. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, Gregory and Gino.
Yeah, tell us about them, because they were sort of intriguing to me as well, especially, I think, through your sort of bare bones understanding of them. But what you chose to share was so like, whoa.
Well, a lot of description of Gregory and Gino came at the end of the book, which the last chapter had to be taken out, unfortunately, because it was ridiculously mundane, how you basically wind down after a mission. And hopefully, if I sell it the first edition, publisher says we might be able to put that chapter back in on the second, if there is one. But, you know, 25, 26 years old, Gregory had a maybe one-year-old kid. Gino was what we call a guard bum, just going from mission to mission, trying to get orders so he could stay paid.
He liked to tan.
Oh, they loved to tan, and Gregory couldn't tan to save his life. Like I said, as soldiers, they were strong. I'd like them a little bit older for a little bit more maturity, but they were aggressive. They were natural leaders. I was proud to serve with them.
Why does this day go on so long?
That's the way it goes. If we hadn't hit an IED, yeah, I would have been done by dinner. That would have been awesome. But things happen.
That's a little detail.
Yeah.
If we hadn't hit an IED.
Yeah, well, that wasn't in the plan. I can certainly state that. So, it took 4 hours just to get in position because we had to take that long diversion around to kind of hide from the enemy and trying to avoid IEDs like you do. Then just stuff happens. The press conference did not anticipate having a press conference after a firefight. That was not in the plan. You just do the best you can, and just things drag on. And I'd rather take 10 hours to drive and stay off the IED roads if necessary. And you know, we failed to do that at a certain point in the mission, and two men paid the price.
You know, this day, as I've mentioned, it starts a little before 4 a.m. And the details of just what it's like to get up at that hour when you're about to do what you know you're going to do. And the men on your mission don't really know much about it yet. You're really carrying all this knowledge alone.
Well, I did share the plan with Gino and Gregor and I think one other, I can't remember, obviously Rob
Apel. This is contentious, though.
Well, no, I did share the details with them. Gregory may argue with that. But I know I briefed them on the plan. They didn't share it with the rest of the men, which, you know, it worked out okay because each one of them was commanding a truck and the information was dispersed. I would have liked to have had a little bit more dispersed. These things happen. There were some aspects that I certainly hid from the Afghans, even the general who I trusted literally with my life multiple times. You can never be too sure. This was before the spate of the green on blue, where Afghan forces would kill American advisors. The American advisor mission was very successful. We were hitting the Taliban hard and very successfully, and that's why the Taliban shifted tactics to the green on blue. Driving a wedge between the Afghan National Security Forces and the American advisors was a very good tactic for the Taliban, and I think it was decisive in our fight, and I think that's why we are arguably losing now.
The mundane detail that I have found myself oddly thinking about a lot is the shirt. The shirt that you wear.
Oh, the combat shirt. Those things were awesome.
And it was, can you tell the story of that? It's just a very bizarre little detail.
Okay, so you wear your body armor. It's heavy, it's hot, plates don't breathe. And so we were wearing flame retardant uniforms, called them frackies, flame retardant army combat uniforms. And, or advanced combat, I don't know. Anyways. And so they're so hot, and somebody just ripped the sleeves off and sewed them onto a T-shirt because the main part of the coat is hidden by the body armor. And that was really brilliant. So everyone looked around and was like, oh, wow, he's wearing his uniform. What a good boy. And in reality, he's just wearing a T-shirt. And I was absolutely shocked, remained shocked, that the Army looked at that and instead of banning it, actually went ahead and procured civilian versions of them. My son just got back from his deployment. And he had a newer one, even more improved. So I'm glad to see the combat shirts still exist.
So, and your son, you just said your son. It's interesting to me that you Do you feel differently about your son going into combat than you felt about yourself going into combat?
Of course. In a million ways. But, you know, that's just, he's got his part to play and he's got to follow his life.
So, but that does put you a little bit closer to the position your wife was in when she asked you about your day.
Absolutely.
I'd like to get back to that.
Sure. And, you know, we can communicate in a way that my son and I, that my wife and I can't. I wrote the book to open a conversation with my wife. It did not. It actually closed it. My wife has a vision of me as father and dutiful husband who, you know, made a beef Wellington last night for Mother's Day. I don't think she really liked seeing what I was in combat.
Can you say more about that? I know it's hard.
Yeah.
I can see that it's hard. I'm sorry.
No, it's quite all right. I'm a different person. I'm a different man. I'm certainly not the man she married. You're a very different person when you're hunting down human beings. And let me be very literal. It was called Taliban Safari for a reason. We were hunting them down, and we wanted to kill as many as we could as quickly as we could before they disappeared. And it's not to say that they've done anything wrong to me. They haven't. The number of Pashtuns who have flown aircraft into American skyscrapers remains at zero. So, but that's what it becomes. If you ever watch the movie Band of Brothers, or the series, I should say, Band of Brothers, Captain Spears is always the figure that fascinates me because he seems more in tune with that separation. You didn't stop being who you were on the civilian side. That's still in you. You just got to put that away. I think a lot of the PTSD that we see are soldiers who have not fully recognized or rectified the two different people within them and accepted that some of those feelings that you have in combat, the joy you have when you successfully execute a mission and you kill your enemy, it's joy. It's happiness. We were ecstatic at the end of that mission.
Have you worked hard to get to this place of honesty with yourself about that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It took me a long time. This book was part of that. I don't think you ever fully come to terms with it, but it's speaking with fellow veterans. Some of the guys, they really get into it and understand that difference and can communicate it and be honest and say, look, it's okay to be happy when you win a battle. You should. But, you know.
Can you explain that a little more? Is it partly just the way that anyone who tries to do anything that by succeeding at doing that thing?
No, it's not. Thucydides, Homer, even the Bible, there's no guilt about what they did in combat. You know, you read Homer, they glorify in it. And if you die in battle, more the glory to you. You compete at great things. I think that dark side of the human species, and you see it in chimps. We just think chimps just sat around and ate bananas all day. No, they're vicious little bastards. And so are humans. And civilization has a veneer that allows us to function and to cooperate and do all those things and to not do those bad things. I found in combat, and it was frightening to see, how thin the veneer of civilization really is.
When you talk about young, I mean, you have not sort of casually thought about the dark side of humanity.
No, I haven't.
This seems like a process.
Well, yeah. Combat, especially close combat, where you can see the people you're killing, it's existential. It changes who you are. And if you don't really analyze it, talk to others about it. We have veteran organizations. The internet has been fantastic for a networking opportunity to get together, talk about it. If you don't really work out those emotions and those things that you went through, if you're experienced in close combat, it'll tear you up. And writing the book was a start, and then talking to the friends. It took years to become comfortable talking about this, and my wife doesn't want to hear it.
When you say that, she read the book.
Yes.
What was her response?
She kind of looked at me, and she's like, you were stupid about 7 times in this book, like really stupid. I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. I took risks. I gambled. I gambled with my life and her future.
And it seems like the pressure to not tell the truth after you've been to war is immense.
It is. And I think it's important to share those stories.
That was Paul Darling talking about his book, Taliban Safari, One Day in the Life of Sir Gagan Valley from the University Press of Kansas. We spoke in May. The conversation really stood out to us because of Paul's reflections on combat and how it affects people, what it brings out in you. and how that can be hard to reconcile with the rest of your life. If you want to grab a link to anything you heard on today's show, you can get it at kcur.org/Central Standard. While you're there, sign up to have Central Standard sent to you every day like a podcast. kcur.org/Central Standard, and talk to us on Twitter. We're at @KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Tune back in tomorrow, same time, same place, for more of our favorite conversations of 2019. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.